This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy, and it's not a matter of if schools will resume in the fall, says Secretary of Education Betsy DeVos. The form they'll take is still a bit up in the air. The limitations that the federal government has to decide how schools open and what they look like when they do, how they operate when they do, is limited. You know, education, state and local matter, particularly local matters. So it's interesting to listen to President Trump make the push for school reopening, for Secretary of Education Betsy DeVos to make the push for school reopening. But ultimately, this is going to be decided, as was said at the outset, school district by school district, as it's being decided college by college.
And President Trump yesterday met with, you know, teachers, administrators, and of course, parents who want their kids back in school in the fall.
Just announced that the schools will be open in the fall, and we hope that most schools are going to be open. We don't want people to make political statements or do it for political reasons. They think it's going to be good for them politically, so they keep the schools closed. No way. So we're very much going to put pressure on governors and everybody else to open the schools, to get them open. And it's very important. It's very important for our country. It's very important for the well-being of the student and the parents. So we're going to be putting a lot of pressure on open your schools.
If you don't open in the fall, you're going to lose them for years. And it's going to take forever to get them back up to speed, really. I mean, their brains right now, Dan, are mush.
Well, we know the Brown University study that we cited last week that finds that kids last year only saw about a third to half of their normal annual gains in math and reading. That's generally speaking what the numbers were. And, you know, this is not a K through 12 school system in America that's killing it with respect to reading and math skills it imparts on children to begin with. So that sort of deterioration is substantial. It's significant. But there's an underlying issue that's not being discussed as sort of the policymakers. I mean, it's being discussed a little bit. I shouldn't say it's completely being ignored.
What's that?
But the policymakers, should we open? Shouldn't we open? We're going to open. You're going to open. We're not going to open. You're not going to tell us what to do. A parent's going to send their kids back to school. You have so many people that, again, are so riddled with fear, have been so lobotomized through propaganda that, you know, you look at this. You have professional athletes who don't want to play their professional sports. You have people who don't want to go back to work. You have people who don't want to sit outside and have a drink, even though you can do all of those things. So what's to say that you're not going to have a substantial number of parents who don't want their kids to go back to school, even in you follow sort of the Ivy League model of some classes go back and this semester and other classes go back that semester, and most of it's online and you do all these other protocols. What percentage of parents will not send their kids back, don't feel comfortable sending their kids back? It's not safe. I want my child to learn, but I also want it to live. 312-642-5600, turkey.pro answer line. 64636, DA, turkey.pro text line. How many times have you heard that?
I know.
Yeah,
well,
I want
the teachers,
work,
too.
But I want to work, but I also want to live.
Here's a Broward County superintendent, because not everybody's on board. And you said it's going to come down to the local level.
We will never compromise the health and safety of our students, teachers, and staff. That's our highest priority, period.
So, and then there's.
And what if the teachers don't want to go back?
Well,
like we talked about yesterday with Georgia Tech.
Yeah, 45%. They questioned a lot of teachers in this latest survey about who wants to go back and who doesn't. And Dan, only 45% want to go back in some form or way.
I bet. Why do I want to go back? I'm being paid to
do nothing.
Yeah, to hang out.
I don't want to, you know, leave my house. You know, there's travel times to get to school. Sometimes people in the suburbs have to travel to the city. You know, why can't I just stay in my pajamas in the kitchen and and flip on the computer.
In addition to, by the way, right, we know about the Brown study with respect to the gains that were not made in reading and math. We also know from an IHME study that the virtual classroom experience was basically a failure. Didn't happen. Sort of the two studies are sort of linked.
Well, yeah. And again, I said this yesterday. E-learning was really Fortnite Chapter 3, Season 2. And every mom knows, and we talk about it, because you go down, you can only police your kids so much. It was exhausting. And my kids are good kids, but still, Dan, you know, that's, and I talked to their child psychiatrist. He's like, that's, let them grieve. They're grieving, too, with the loss of school. So if their only communication with other kids is through these video games, because they're talking to each other with these video games and playing video games. That's their only social interaction with the outside world when they were sheltered in place.
They're child psychologists.
Well, I called one. What's that? What? I've got what? So I'm doing the right thing. Don't be shaming me over there. On the other side of the plexiglass.
When you grew up in the Ozzy and Harriet days, did you know any kid who saw a child psychologist?
No.
Yeah.
But back to the American Academy of Pediatrics, the academic, physical, and mental upsides associated with returning children to school outweighs the risks of contracting the virus. That's how I feel. I will send my kids back. I'd send them back yesterday if I could, because they need some interaction.
Well, again, Dr. Scott Atlas, former head of neuroradiology at Stanford University, I think had the definitive line on this when he said that preventing the kids from going back to school, not reopening schools, is the dumbest policy in modern history.
They're already back to school in Europe. In the Netherlands, they had a higher death rate than we did. They sent their kids back to school in May because they have a different school year. So they get out in mid-July. They're already back, K through 12. And everything's fine. This one Florida father, Dan, has three girls.
I think developing social skills is an important thing that you do at this age. And I think that it's been a real challenge for them.
And one thing, President Trump yesterday had a message for Harvard who, you know, really, it was very provocative and I think a crazy decision already to only allow 40% of the kids back, but everything's e-learning.
Great. It's going to be a much better climate than it is right now. We're on the right side of things. Deborah, I think we can say that. A lot of work has been done. We understand what we're doing very, very well.
He's getting
again, mortality rate, the lowest anywhere in the world. And we want to get this done and we want to get our country going again. Economically, we're doing well. We want to do well with the education. I see where Harvard announced that they're closing for the season or for the year. I think it's ridiculous. I think it's an easy way out.
Yeah.
And I think they ought to be ashamed of themselves. You want to know the truth. But
Harvard,
I noticed that today.
And yeah, Harvard, Princeton. It's ridiculous.
Jim in Crown Point.
You know, Harvard is charging you $50,000.
Oh yeah. What decade are you living in? Yeah, you increase that by 60%. But go ahead.
No, I'm a semester, $50,000 a semester.
Yeah.
To sit at your parents' kitchen table and learn. How many of these kids at 18? How crazy were you? You had the attention span of a gnat. You have to be forced to learn at that age. There's no way. It's a joke.
Thanks for the call, Jim. Now again, Harvard. Everybody comes back to campus, but then you just sit in your dorm room and take classes online. It's really something.
And it's freshmen, freshmen, juniors, the fall season, and then sophomore, seniors, the spring season.
Yeah. We're calling
ridiculous.
Them season now instead of semesters.
Yeah.
We don't call them, because President Trump says seasons, now we call them seasons. That's been renamed too. Mark on the south side.
Good morning. It's not an issue yet, but what's going to happen if the kids don't go back to school, the private schools, mainly the Catholic schools there in Chicago? There's no way that the schools can expect the parents to pay the rate that they're paying,
right?
You know, $10,000-$15,000 to go.
No,
and it might become an issue.
No, it's already
issue.
I mean, in terms of the survival of those schools, that's what you're talking about? That's a real issue. Absolutely it is. That's right. Thanks for the call, Mark. Greg in LaGrange.
Hi, how are you this morning?
Good.
President Trump's best weapon against the governors, because this is a state and local matter, like you pointed out, would be to just pound the statistics that Senator Rand Paul presented to Dr. Fauci over and over and over and over and over again.
Yeah.
And pound the statistic that Amy talked about kids' health. I know from personal experience, my nephew doesn't want to go back to e-learning. My question to you, Dan, is, how many of these kids that were in Chicago public schools that were told to log in from home if they had computers actually did that? How many public school kids actually took advantage of this?
They missed thousands. I know for a fact that 2,000 plus, they couldn't even get a hold of to hand them a computer. They just completely lost them in the system.
Here's the other thing. Here's why I'm the glass half empty guy. If parents cared, we wouldn't be in the situation where we are right now. I can speak for my parents and probably everybody else's parents when we were younger, because they were stay-at-home moms and dads. They were at parent-teacher conferences. And they were in teachers' faces every time they met. That does not happen now. Mm. Parents, single parents, whatever, have turned their kids over to be educated in everything to the school. It's the school's job. They want those kids to come back as if they've been parented all along, and it's just a completely deceitful way to approach life. It's just horrible.
Thanks for the call, Greg. I appreciate it. Just going back to that IHME study that I referenced, right, that we talked about previously, looked at 477 school districts nationwide. The report finds only 27% of districts require teachers to record whether students participate in remote classes. One in four school districts. During the first 2 weeks of the shutdown, some 15,000 L.A. students failed to show up for classes or do any schoolwork. Philadelphia Inquirer reported 10 weeks in, the Philadelphia School District registered just 61% of students attending on an average day. Boston Globe reporting Boston students, half of students are logging into online classes, submitting assignments online in a typical day. You can expect that at best, the CPS was in that area, probably worse as it normally is.
50%, maybe 55%. I don't know.
Greg and Schomburg, the other Greg.
Dan and Amy, first of all, good morning. Question, isn't there an issue of liability insurance from the local standpoint? And thus, a la the shutdown of the DMVs about a week after they were open when somebody got COVID, isn't it going to be a situation where the anybody that raises a flag and potentially says they're going to sue a school district shuts the school district down?
Yeah, well, this is the importance of, thanks for the call, Greg, of that indemnification of businesses and indemnification of government institutions, I suppose, that was being pushed by Mitch McConnell, was being pushed by President Trump. So you don't have predatory trial lawyers gum up the reopening of America.
Right. And I'll sign a waiver. I know every parent that wants their kid back in school would sign a waiver saying we would not sue if little Johnny got sick from COVID.
That helps. It's not dispositive of the issue. It helps. It also helps that school districts are in a much stronger position than businesses are, in part because they can afford to finance litigation. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think that would be a cop-out if a school district says, we're not going to reopen and educate kids for fear of litigation. You know, there's fear of litigation every school day. Mm-hmm. So that doesn't absolve anybody from reopening. Mary Kay in Western Springs.
Hi, good morning, you guys. So, yeah, my daughter's college is that there are $22 million, the estimate of the first loss to the, you can't keep your billions and millions straight these days. $22 million is going to be the deficit this year, and next year it's projected to be $44 million deficit to the endowment. Now that is a big number. That is so significant. Look, I mean the kids are not so many are not coming back already, which is bad. My daughter is going back. She's going back. She says no matter what, and to live in a dorm room like you guys were saying, to do what? To maybe go to class, maybe get to be in a lab. You know, I'm going to pay for that. I don't think so.
Thanks, Mary Kay.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. Let freedom ring this afternoon at 2 with Sean Hannity on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. And, Terry Crews, you really stepped in it. That's how Don Lamone started his interview with Terry Crews, the former pro football player turned actor.
Shaming him? That's what he did? Really?
I mean, Terry Crews basically said, he tweeted out, you know, are there good white people? Yes. Are there bad black people? Yes. Basically saying that he stands in unity with all good Christian people, regardless of their color. This shouldn't be a black-white thing. Black Lives Matter shouldn't turn into Black Lives Better. It shouldn't be antagonistic. It should be rooted in sort of common heritage and belief system, regardless of race. That was the extent of his controversial statement that requires Don Lamone to pore over it with him and make sure that he's still on board with Black Lives Matter. So here's what Crews had to say about Black Lives Matter, the organization, not the movement, not the mantra, distinguishing the two. I find that less and less compelling, but nonetheless, here's Terry Crews.
And when you have the leaders of the Black Lives Movement who are now talking about, you know, if we don't get our demands, we're going to burn it down. Other black people who are talking about working with other whites and other races, they're being viewed as sellouts or called Uncle Toms. You start to understand that you are now, you know, being controlled. You're not being treated as loved. You're actually being controlled. Someone wants to control the narrative. And I viewed it as a very, very dangerous self-righteousness that was developing that really viewed themselves as better. It was almost a supremacist move.
So let me jump
where
in,
Terry. They viewed that their black lives mattered a lot more than mine.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636-DA, turnkey.pro text line. There's Terry Crews's concern about the rhetoric coming from the Marxist Black Lives Matter organization. Here is Don Lamone's rejoinder.
So the Black Lives Matter movement is about police brutality and injustice in that manner, not about what's happening in black neighborhoods. There are people who are working on that issue. And if you want to start that issue, why don't you start it? Do you understand what I'm saying?
But when you look at the organization, police brutality is not the only thing they're talking about.
I know that. I agree, but that's not what the Black Lives Matter movement is about, Terry. Black Lives Matter is about police brutality and about criminal justice. It's not about what happens in communities when it comes to crime, black on black crime. People who live near each other, black people, kill each other. Same as whites. 80-some% of white people are killed by white people because of proximity.
Very true.
It's the same thing with black people. That happens in every single neighborhood.
Has Don Lemon read Black Lives Matter's mission statement?
What we believe, it's on their website. Yeah, it's pretty straightforward. There's something else.
He did his homework.
Well, there's something else that's fallacious in Don Lamone's thinking. Surprise, surprise. And that is this idea. No, you have to understand. First of all, it's not true that it's just police brutality focused. Secondly, even if it were true, the idea that you're talking about creating a more just society and you can do it only with respect to this narrow issue of police brutality, but you're not going to take in the behavior that the police are attempting to interdict. You're only going to specifically, when you talk about police, I only want to talk about these very relatively rare incidents of brutality. I don't want to have a larger conversation about policing in America. I don't want to have a larger conversation about the kinds of behavior that dominate police officers' time. I don't want to have that conversation. I'm going to make this as myopic as I can so that I can, well, essentially propagandize from a place of dangerous self-righteousness, as Terry Crews said. That's what Don Lamone is doing because, you know, he's dope. He's the dumbest man on television, as President Trump said. And every night he proves President Trump right. And so he did in this conversation. What's more important than what Don Lamone has to say is that you have people like Terry Crews speaking out. If only conservatives had such courage as Terry Crews does, they would be ignored. Terry Crews gets, hated on
He's ridiculed on social media.
In a material way.
God, why don't they leave him alone?
And it's not just Terry Crews, who's actually spent the time to go to the Black Lives Matter website to listen to what the Black Lives Matter founders, Patrice Cullors and Alicia Garza, actually have to say, actually what they believe, actually what they're trying to do, paying a little bit of attention to what they're focused on, that these protests or worse, protests aren't bad, protests or something worse than a protest, which is not bad, a peaceful protest, but you know what I'm saying, talking about violence and violence in the name of Black Lives Matter. The identitarian politics, also worse.
But Black Lives Matter should now change their mission statement and focus on black-on-black killings. They should come to Chicago.
What do they should do? Who cares what they do? Here's what you should do. Well, that's not what they want to do. They want to be Marxists. Let's discuss what they are.
Okay.
What we should do as a society, where our focus should be, that's a conversation. Why, you're going to redefine what Black Lives Matter's mission is? Yeah, okay, good luck with that.
But listen to the tall white chick.
But it's not just Terry Crews. It's also Marcellus Wiley, formerly of ESPN, now over at Fox Sports 1. Marcellus Wiley, the other day, we didn't get to this earlier in the week, but we should have. I forgot, actually. But he had this great riff about Black Lives Matter.
Yeah.
What they say they believe, and take somebody at their word and what they believe, particularly when they repeat it over and over again and then act in furtherance of it. And what they believe runs afoul of what Marcellus Wiley, another former pro football player, believes and what his current mission is, which is to be a husband and a father.
I don't know how many people really look into the mission statement of Black Lives Matter, but I did. And when you look into it, there's a couple things that jump out to me. Being a father and a husband, that's my mission in life right now. How do I reconcile that, what I just told you, with this mission statement that says, quote, we dismantle the patriarchal practice. We disrupt the Western prescribed nuclear family structure requirement. Children from single parent homes versus two parent homes. The children from the single parent homes, this is in 1995, I was reading this. 5 times more likely to commit suicide. 6 times more likely to be in poverty. 9 times more likely to drop out of high school. 10 times more likely to abuse chemical substances. 14 times more likely to commit rape. 20 times more likely to end up in prison. And 32 times more likely to run away from home. I knew that. You know why I knew it? Because a lot of my friends didn't have family structures that were nuclear like mine, and they found themselves outside of their dreams and goals and aspirations.
Wow.
How about that? I mean, that's where leadership needs to come, too. I'm sorry to say. I mean, it's great that Marcellus Wiley is saying what he's saying. It's great that Terry Crews is saying what they're saying. It's perfectly sensible. It's sad that you have to rely on a handful of athletes and now commentators or actors rather than on people actually in charge of our school systems, universities, corporate boardrooms, churches. This whole thing, this whole experiment called America may end up rising or falling based on the Marcellus Wileys and Terry Crews of the world. And, you know, thankfully they're here.
312-642-5600 is our turnkey.pro answer line. 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment.
Jason Whitlock, who we've been talking quite a bit about on this show recently, and I've talked even more about on my other show, my syndicated show, he was on with Tucker the other night. And he has written some really strong pieces in the last couple of weeks on this topic. Here's Jason Whitlock on Black Lives Matter, following up with Terry Crews and Marcellus Wiley. Thank goodness for Jason Whitlock as well.
And so when I look at what the NFL is doing, this goes against every value that the NFL has built itself on. Professional sports have built themselves on a celebration of Americana and the ideals and values that best exemplify America. They built themselves on unity and unifying the country. If the NFL starts out its season with everyone standing for Lift Every Voice and Sing, the Black National Anthem, and then virtually everyone on the field taking a knee when the Star Spangled Banner plays, I think it's going to be, if you remember the show Happy Days, the jump the shark moment when it's like, okay, Happy Days is over. The NFL will run off a nice fat chunk of its audience and will never be seen the same again because of the failure of leadership throughout the NFL. There's no way you can do any homework on Black Lives Matters and not see that it's a Marxist political organization. It's right. not about black death. It's not about black men. It is a political move. It's a communist political move. If for those people that stand on religious values, and this is where I say just the failure of men, I've seen many of these guys, they claim their Christianity and their religious beliefs. Do they understand Black Lives Matter? Communist Marxism is anti-religious. This is a historic failure of men and leadership. This is cowardice at its highest level. This is the NFL jumping the shark and saying we've quit being who we said we are. We're now something else because our money's on the line and we don't stand for the values we said we stood for.
I love the point he makes about can you imagine if everybody stands for the black national anthem and then everybody or a lot of people, a lot of players on the field take the knee for the national anthem. What a moment that would be. That's a moment of national unity. As Whitlock said, that's representative of Americana, the way the NFL has always built itself and professional sports generally.
Just leave the national anthem alone. You don't need anything before it. You don't need anything after it.
Randy in Crown Point, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Morning, guys. You know, I find it ironic that when you have the people like the Marcellus Wiley, Terry Crews, Whitlock, these are very accomplished, mostly inner city African-Americans that have grown up to be extremely wealthy. And instead of them being the mouthpiece of the black movement to try and better things for them, we're letting a bunch of white, rich, snobby, liberal, limousine liberals speak for the black man. Those men actually know what it was like to be poor. She knew what it was like to be poor and then accomplish something. Now, Brock, not so much. But when you look at this, what has happened to America? It's white apologetics. It always will be. I don't know why, but it wasn't like this before. We just lived for the American dream. But why can't Cruz and these men be the mouthpiece, the spokesperson, the leaders of these organizations?
Well, thanks for the call. Because they're Marxists, that's why. I mean, the fact is they're providing an important counterpoint and in a timely manner, too. Brian in Westchester.
Blacks killing blacks is a criminal justice issue. So I don't know where Don gets it from. That's a criminal justice issue, and they are being ignored.
Well, thanks for the call. Right. Yeah, I mean, it's right. The and his statement, like, proximity is why people kill each other. Whites kill whites and blacks kill blacks. Well,
it's not
the carnage going on in the urban centers is distinct from any white on white killing on a per capita basis. It's not close. That is just a complete red herring. Of course it is, because it's Don Lemon and he's the dumbest man on TV.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Well, well, well. Mainly leftists, not exclusively leftists, but mainly leftists, many with profile, signed a joint letter that will appear in Harper's Magazine's October issue, but it's posted now.
You still getting that on a monthly basis?
Oh, yeah. A letter on justice and open debate. Our cultural institutions are facing a moment of trial. Powerful protests for racial and social justice are leading to overdue demands for police reform along with wider calls for greater equality and inclusion across our society, not least in higher education, journalism, philanthropy, and the arts. But,
yes,
this needed reckoning has also intensified a new set of moral attitudes and political commitments that tend to weaken our norms of open debate and toleration of differences in favor of ideological conformity. You don't say. The free exchange of information and ideas, the lifeblood of a liberal society, is daily becoming more constricted. While we have come to expect this on the radical right, really, censoriousness is also spreading more widely in our culture. An intolerance of opposing views, a vogue for public shaming and ostracism, and the tendency to dissolve complex policy issues into a blinding moral certainty. It is now all too common, to hear calls for swift and severe retribution in response to perceived transgressions of speech and thought. We've noticed. The stifling atmosphere, they conclude, will ultimately harm the most vital causes of our time. The restriction of debate invariably hurts those who lack power. It makes everyone less capable of small-d democratic participation. The way to defeat bad ideas is by exposure, argument, persuasion, not trying to silence and wish them away.
Really?
If we don't defend the very thing on which our work depends, we shouldn't expect the public or the state to defend it for us. And you have such important people as Noam Chomsky, J.K. Rowling. You got some,
maybe heavy hitters. I mean,
you got Coleman Hughes, you got Jonathan Haidt, you got some people that are not leftist. Coleman Hughes certainly is, so John McWhorter. But it's mostly leftist. Wynton Marsalis.
Oh, yeah.
Ann Applebaum, Salman Rushdie. Huh?
Really? What?
Yeah. Huh. Jeet Herr at The Nation. He's a leftist, hard leftist. Nadine Strossen. Oh, yeah. And so you believe their commitment? Francis Fukuyama. Yeah. No, not the end of history. Although maybe he was just about three decades early.
Ted Cruz wrote, it's the signs of the apocalypse. Never in my life have I ever agreed with Noam Chomsky.
Noam,
excuse me.
Yeah. I know. And that's all well and good. And it's a statement that could have been written 30 years ago, but wasn't at the sort of advent. Well, could have been written 60 years ago, but wasn't. But certainly at the advent of so-called political correctness on campus when speech codes were being imposed.
That's when it was needed the most.
This is 30 years ago. This strikes me, I'm a skeptic.
You are?
This strikes me as very similar to the hype surrounding the University of Chicago statement from 5 years ago that was supposedly some sort of flag planting for free speech on campus. Turned out not to be that much, really, in practice, including at the University of Chicago. Didn't move the needle much. And I suspect that the leftists who signed this letter, oh, and by the way, if I was Coleman Hughes and John McWhorter, I don't think I'd sign a letter that includes a false claim about the censoriousness of the radical right, whatever that is, in the minds of the authors of this letter. Also, resistance must not be allowed to harden its own brand of dogma or coercion, which right-wing demagogues are already exploiting. Oh, it's right-wing demagogues exploiting what this cancel culture is doing that you're arguing against, that you're afraid of. You know why you're afraid of it? Because you're starting to see they're going to come for you, too. This is the YouTube movement. So you'll pardon me if I'm not bowled over by this statement of solidarity in advance
of thought and speech.
And yeah, in advance of persuasion, not coercion, and other concepts that we should have all understood and been committed to since we were in grade school. J.K. Rowling. Malcolm Gladwell also on this list. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm not impressed. 312, Glory Steinem.
Oh,
just keep going
really?
Down the list. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636-DA, turnkey.pro text line. I am not impressed, but we're supposed to be. Are you impressed? You think this is going to be a watershed moment that turns the tide against the Jacobins? I mean, remember, these are people that have sort of been rooting for, a lot of them, not everybody unless, rooting for the Jacobins, turning a blind eye to the Jacobins, saying, oh, just, you know, they have a point. They're raising some important issues. That's what you hear from these same people who are now what are the vanguard of free thought and free speech in a free America. Come on. This is flim-flammery. Kathleen on the South Side, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hey, good morning, Dan and Amy. Great show, as always. You guys have been knocking it out the park these past few weeks.
Thank you.
I just got to say, Dan, day after day, you've been highlighting and trying to hammer home the idea that when it comes to these so-called progressives and, of course, the higher-ups who set the vision, the ones that are implementing that vision that we're seeing right before our eyes, the Democrat politicians and members of the media, Hollywood, Black Lives Matter co-founders, corporate boards, local county boards, et cetera. You know, we got to really be willing to admit that these are not empty vessel figureheads, so to speak, that we can just dismiss as inexperienced or clueless or inept. They've bought in. They know exactly what they're doing. And you're right. They are bad actors with an ideology that I think most people, and I include myself, most people of goodwill, we're either not able to see it or we're not willing to allow ourselves to see it, let alone accept it and deal with it. And so I'm calling to say you have provoked me to pull off my shelf once again, probably the third or fourth time. But I got to get my C.S. Lewis Screw Tape Letters book out.
There you go.
And I've got to read it again from cover to cover because we're dealing with something the likes of which I wouldn't say I wasn't able to see it. It was right in front of my face, but I just wouldn't allow myself to see it.
That's such a good point. That's such a good point. I really like that distinction. It was right there. I just wouldn't allow I saw it, but I wouldn't allow myself to see it. I wouldn't allow myself to
feel it?
Internalize it. Mm-hmm. This is what's really happening. What I'm seeing is what's actually happening. No, it can't really be. No, they can't really be doing. That can't really be their agenda. They can't really be bad people. No, this will never happen here. Okay. All right. Kathleen, thanks so much for the call. Really appreciate it. Good stuff. Tom in Deer Park.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Another great topic and great coverage by your show. And as far as the cancel culture on the left, I think they've eaten themselves too far. I agree with you on that. I don't know how they can recover this. But to the right-wing demagogues they speak of, I don't even think they're talking about the so-called Catholic integralists. I think they're talking about one person and one person only, the one that tweets out about Comcast and NBC and the Washington Post and the New York Times. That stuff has an effect after a while. Not on most people. I think most people think it's chum and nonsense. But I think that's who they're referring to, unnamed in that letter, and I wish them luck.
Yeah, okay, Tom. Actually, they name him. The forces of a liberalism are gaining strength throughout the world and have a powerful ally in Donald Trump, who represents a real threat to democracy. I was waiting for somebody to make that point, and Tom is an ever-Trumper. I figured might be that someone, and so thank you for walking into that for me. And this is why I have a real problem with some of our friends of the show, certainly Coleman Hughes and John McWhorter, both part of the 1776 response to the 1619 Project. I don't know how they bring themselves to sign this letter. I really don't. Oh, by the way, concurrent with this, because I wonder if they would characterize, say, any member of the Socialist Spice Girls as illiberal, as a demagogue. Would you? Jonathan Haidt, who's on this, heterodoxy? Mm-hmm. Ron Sullivan, Harvard Law, would you? Ilhan Omar,
Yeah, the squad is back.
Talking about the revolution that she wants to facilitate. You know, we need to not only defund police, we need to reorder our economy and political system completely.
As long as our economy and political systems prioritize profit without considering who is profiting, who is being shut out, we will perpetuate this inequality. So we cannot stop at criminal justice system. We must begin the work of dismantling the whole system of oppression wherever we find it.
We got to dismantle our economy, which is consistent with what AOC's former COS said, you know, last year. The Green New Deal is always about dismantling the economy. It's not about saving the environment. So is that a demagogue? Is that somebody who is illiberal? Is that somebody who is a champion of free thought and free speech and a free economy and a free America? How about Sharma Stewart? She's a Seattle City Council member. Yes, yeah, Seattle proper, not the nation formerly known as Chaz/Chop. Here's what she had to say on the occasion of Seattle imposing the so-called Amazon payroll tax.
I have a message for Jeff Bezos and his class. If you attempt again to overturn the Amazon tax, working people will go all out in the thousands to defeat you. And we will not stop there, because you see, we are fighting for far more than this tax. We are preparing the ground for a different kind of society. And if you, Jeff Bezos, want to drive that process forward by lashing out against us in our modest demands, then so be it, because we are coming for you and your rotten system. We are coming to dismantle this deeply oppressive, racist, sexist, violent, utterly bankrupt system of capitalism, this police state. We cannot and will not stop until we overthrow it and replace it with a world based instead on solidarity, genuine democracy, and equality, a socialist world. Thank you.
Oh, my, no.
Oh, no. Thank you.
Yes.
Really. If I was Jeff Bezos, I would be getting out of Seattle and going to somewhere else where they're more business friendly. That's a terrorist statement. I mean, she's a harasser, a terrorizer. What?
So you've heard from.
She's left me scratching my head.
You've heard from Sharma Stewart in Seattle. You've heard from Brotherly Love Spice, MF-er Spice, Francis Parker Spice. That would be Rashida Tlaib and Ayanna Pressley.
Well, Ayanna Pressley, she couldn't talk because her Zoom call was on the fritz yesterday.
They are sponsors of the BREATHE Act, which provides for defunding the police and setting up reparations for people who are either black
or
were harmed by cops. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Again, the statement from those mainly high-profile leftist academics and entertainers and so forth, you feel like that's a proportional response to the place we're at now, the advance the so-called cancel culture has made, the control Jacobins are exerting? Dan in Libertyville.
Hey, I want to thank you guys for illustrating what I was talking about yesterday and how I fear we're going to be like the pre-World War II Nazi Germany, where we're a society of snitches, and if you're not one of them, then they're out to get you. That last person you played comes right out and says it in plain language. So, thanks
for comply. Yeah,
thanks,
if you don't comply, we're going to form a solidarity against you, and we're going to get you.
Well, and
the money from the proceeds from this tax bill, which passed Monday night 7-2, is going to go towards, ready, coronavirus relief, and then later on put towards addressing homelessness and housing problems.
You know, you're going to
tax you 2.4% if you make over $400,000 a year.
No, it's
and it's more than that.
It's payroll like expenses payroll taxes based on salary levels. Yeah. Right, exactly.
Between 0.7% and 2.4%.
The point is though, of course, to defend Councilwoman Stewart, you know, you're gonna break a few eggs when you're gonna create heaven on earth. There's gonna be a few eggs broken. There's gonna have to be a few people sidelined or silenced or disappeared, whatever. That's just the heavy burden of bringing forth utopia. So
that's the cost of doing business in Seattle. And if he was a smart, savvy businessman, he's not going to be harassed like that from city council members. Pull up ranks, pull up your stakes, and get out of Seattle.
Yeah.
God.
He's worth like $120 billion.
I know, but
he's not. He's a smart, savvy businessman.
Yeah. Okay.
Mike in Crown Point.
Morning, Dan and Amy. I see sort of a historical allegory what's going on now. Your call back during the Soviet Union collapse, towards the end there, they arrested Gorbachev, and the Communist Party sort of unleashed the military on the population. And what made the difference was they wouldn't fire on their own people. I think that's the main drive on Black Lives Matter, is they saw that, and what they want to do is get rid of law enforcement, replace it with their own hand-groomed police, so that when it comes time to point the guns at the population, they'll fire. I think that's what they're thinking. Sort of like an Animal Farm, where one of the dogs on the farm has a litter of puppies, and they immediately get taken away and raised someplace else in secret. They come back later, and they turn the dogs loose on, you know, the animal population. I think that these people are deceptive. They a lot of misdirection, and they're thinking farther ahead, and we're giving them credit for it. Thanks.
Thanks for the call, Mike, and the Russian references to keep the Russian references going. Frank in Arlington Heights.
Yes, I think this statement by some of these very leftist people should be essentially that we're all kulaks now. Mm-hmm. You know, the kulaks were the Ukrainian rebels who resisted Stalinism and collective farming, and I think some of these people are realizing that, like you said, Dan, they're coming for everybody.
How did that work out for the kulaks, Frank?
I think 10 million of them were killed by these Stalinists. They were starved. So, this is horrible. Yeah.
Thanks, Frank. Kemp in Stillman Valley.
Yeah, hey, good morning, Dan and Amy. You know, this is what it is, the Transform of America. Barack Obama, we love the police. We love white America. We love our founding fathers. Wait a minute. No, we don't. Screw all those people. We don't care. Let's make it in our own Stalinist, frickin' Marxist, racist, frickin' America that we were founded on.
All right.
What a bunch of crap.
Okay.
Anyway, have a great day.
Hey, thanks
you
for the
do,
call, Kip.
Kip.
Yeah.
Yay, it's Stillman Valley. Yay.
Just to put a fine point on what Kip was saying, we go to Angela Rye, who's CNN contributor. Of course she was. She was on with Fredo Cuomo last night.
So, Chris, maybe it is that people will say, you know, they're still my founding fathers. That alone, the patriarchal sentiment that exists in that, I think also has to be reframed. Why aren't there any black women heroes on Mount Rushmore? We can't even get Harriet Tubman on the $20 bill after. So if 41 of the 56 signers of the Declaration of Independence could talk about these truths that they hold as self-evident and then go to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, but there's a large footnote. I wasn't considered human to them.
That's not true. But, you know, I get the overall point. Welcome to year zero in America, and you have utopia to look forward to right around the corner.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, and Ghislaine Maxwell, such promise. Just 6 years ago, she was prepared to dedicate her life to saving the planet.
At 1,500 feet, I switched on the lights, hoping to see a new mythical sea creature. But in fact, what I saw was a plastic hanger.
No.
I was so absolutely devastated, but it was at that moment that I realized that I was really going to dedicate the rest of my life to taking an involvement with and bringing an education around the ocean.
Mm-hmm. And instead, she dedicated the rest of her life as a free woman to sex trafficking underage girls.
And she finally got caught. Picked up at her New Hampshire estate.
So many questions surround her arrest, why she was in New Hampshire, why now, what information does she have that could implicate those who participated in the illegal activities that Jeffrey Epstein and she arranged. For some additional questions and perhaps some answers and insights, we're pleased to be joined again by Dominic Green, the Life and Arts Editor of Spectator USA, contributor to the Wall Street Journal and the New Criterion. Dominic, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Good morning, Dan. Good morning, Amy.
Good morning. And so you've got questions surrounding Ghislaine Maxwell, too. In the 4 or 5 days now that she's been in custody, do we have any more insight as to the timing of the arrest, why she was in New Hampshire rather than in France or Britain? And just what exactly she may be able to offer and on whom she may be able to offer it?
Well, these are the questions, aren't they? I mean, if you were Ghislaine Maxwell and your longtime friend and protector Jeffrey Epstein has died in dubious circumstances, would you have stuck around given that you knew the FBI wanted to talk to you and that you were suspect number one? She has British passports. She has French passports. She has lots and lots of money. Therefore, there must have been a reason why she chose to stay in the U.S. She would have made a decision about what was the safest option. And it's a very strange thing. Why would sticking around in order to be picked up by the FBI at some point be the safest option? So to me, it doesn't really add up. It looks more like she decided to stay in the U.S. because she believed, and this is what I've heard from more than one source, she believed she was still covered by the immunity deal that Epstein worked out in Florida in 2007.
Mm-hmm. Well, I heard an interview yesterday with her best friend, and she said that she made the rounds to call all of her friends to say, you know, goodbye, and they thought that that was strange, that she that they thought that she knew she was going to be picked up any minute now.
Absolutely. And I honestly, I don't have any evidence, of course, to support this. I would say the balance of probability suggests the FBI knew where she was for a very long time and that the timing of her arrest was something that was quite possibly, as you're saying, not a surprise to her and quite possibly by mutual agreement. I find it very hard to believe that her lawyers wouldn't have been speaking to the FBI ahead of her arrest, for instance.
There's been some suggestion that Epstein and or Maxwell may have been FBI informants at some point.
Well, we have a document from 2008 when Epstein was convicted on this, what now looks like a suspiciously easy plea deal in Florida. We have an FBI document from 2008 saying that in return for this, Epstein, and I quote, provided information to the FBI. He, I'm told, insisted also that Maxwell be excluded from any prosecution in Florida, despite the fact that we know from the unsealed court documents that her name was all over them as well as his. So from that point onwards, you have to assume that the FBI has some kind of interest in this and that she has some kind of relationship with it. And legally speaking, there is a case to be made. And of course, she's got very good lawyers now. They're going to make the case that she's still covered by that immunity.
Well, and so that's interesting. So one, that immunity deal was also highly unusual. I don't know what Alex Acosta was doing, but that is very, very strange to offer immunity for known as well as unknown co-conspirators prospectively. That's
wouldn't
what
we all like one of those.
Yes, exactly. Right.
An astonishing thing, really.
Yeah.
Acosta didn't know what he was doing because afterwards he said in 2016 that, you know, he was told to back off because Epstein, quote, belonged to intelligence. And then he decided he didn't know what he was saying and said, no, it's not true. I didn't say that. It didn't happen.
Right.
The whole thing is utterly murky and it doesn't reflect well at all, of course, on the FBI or any of the government employees who bungled the prosecution.
But hasn't a federal judge interceded on that non-prosecution deal and said that is unconscionable and it is not in force?
Well, of course they are now, yes. What's amazing and what we should be asking is why was it possible to argue otherwise for 12 years, given what we've known subsequently about Epstein? The whole thing should have been scrubbed immediately. Another thing which came out just yesterday, in fact, was that Deutsche Bank had been fined $150 million for money laundering on Epstein's behalf as late as 2013. Mm-hmm. So, you know, both Epstein and Maxwell were allowed to continue operating for a long time, more than a decade. And that is a question we should ask. How exactly was this allowed to take place? And why exactly was this allowed to take place in the decade between the Florida deal and Epstein's death?
Do you think that she has videotapes of sex acts that were performed on underage girls?
Well, we can't know for certain. We do know that Epstein, you know, was recording stuff in his homes, and we also know this is not an uncommon thing for people to do when they're trying to entrap people for intelligence purposes. Epstein's life is an astonishingly murky and dubious thing. Reports in June came out that he'd been involved in arms dealing and money laundering in the 1980s. And obviously we are focusing on the evidence we have, of course, which is of sex offences. But this only seems to have been one aspect of his criminality. And in a way, that may be an expression of his criminality. He seems to have been involved in everything murky from Iran-Contra onwards over a 20-year time period. Will we really get the details of it? I very much doubt, in fact. In fact, it may be easier for certain parties to be focusing on the known sex allegations and on, say, Maxwell as an opportunity to close the whole story up.
Yeah, what does all of this mean for Prince Andrew there?
Yeah, Randy canceled his golf vacation.
I heard he did.
Well, they were friends for 30 years, and you know, and perhaps more. It is suspected. It's extremely difficult for him to explain away the photograph, and he's not coming out of the UK. His people are insisting, of course, that he has been attempting to speak to the Southern District of New York. But the new prosecutor has taken the same line as the previous one, as Jeffrey Bone. She said, we're still waiting for him to walk in. But, of course, he's not going to walk in. He's not going to walk anywhere near the airport, let alone come to the U.S. He's holed up and hopefully, from his point of view, hopefully waiting that this will blow over. And I think a lot of people are hoping that this will blow over, that Maxwell will either be sentenced or agree not to talk about stuff, and the whole thing can then be brushed under the carpet. The question is, of course, what information would Maxwell trade if she has stuff? Would it perhaps be easier, from her point of view, to dump Prince Andrew than to dump a well-connected person in the U.S., or indeed dump her relationship with one of the intelligence agencies? The answer, of course, is, from her point of view, it's a lot safer to sell out Prince Andrew because she'd probably, you know, not have an accident in her cell shortly after.
Yeah, sure. You want to stay away from Clinton world if you don't want to have an accident, perhaps. Also, with Randy Andy helping her by doing BBC interviews to explain how innocent he is. If he does one more of those, then I think he'll be indicted in absentia just on what he says, much less what she has to say.
Well, it's true, but of course, he, in a way, is exculpating her of this charge. When he's trying to dig himself out of it, he's also digging her out by saying, no, there was nothing untoward, nothing happened, I don't know her, I don't know anything. It is possible also that these sex charges against Maxwell relate to events in 1994 to 1997. That's quite a long time ago. Obviously, the FBI has built up a case. Epstein's domestic staff, housekeepers, who are also alleged to be pimping children to him, they've all disappeared. So the chances are that they've testified and been tucked away somewhere. You'd imagine the FBI has a strong case. But the perjury charges against Maxwell from 2016, these aren't, you know, they're not that big and they're not likely to make much of a difference. It's almost like they're stacking these charges on top in order that it might all add up.
The six counts against her, it seemed to me light as well, and it seemed to me they were looking to make it appear more substantial than it was, even despite the serious nature of the charges we're discussing. I just go back again to the Palm Beach Police Department in 06 to before the feds took it over. They put together a case with what they report was 35 to 40 girls who are willing to testify to what happened to them, what Epstein and Maxwell did. And here we are more than a decade later, and we're basically talking about still the work product from the Palm Beach Police Department, the only organization that comes out looking good from the information that we know and has been memorialized in that Filthy Rich documentary series, is the Palm Beach Police Department. Here we are again talking about the Department of Justice and the FBI either engaged in very dubious, unethical activity or just exhibiting rank incompetence. I don't know which, but as you probably know from that documentary, there were FBI agents that were decrying what wasn't happening with Epstein back in 06 to 08 to after that plea deal and to the intervening decade.
Absolutely. And of course, we should always remember that incompetence is a very powerful driver of these things. But what we do have, and this is the crucial thing about what happened in Florida, you're right, the Palm Beach Police Department did the right thing. They assembled this massive file that would have been enough to put away Epstein, and we have to imagine Maxwell for life. And the FBI, for its own reasons, decided not to pursue that file. And that is one question which is very clear to us. You know, there's a lot of murky allegations and he says, she says about the whole Epstein saga, but this is one thing we have on paper, clearly documented. The FBI chose not to prosecute, and therefore we should ask, why didn't it? Mm-hmm. And of course, Maxwell may well know the answer to that question.
He is Dominic Green, Life and Arts Editor of Spectator USA, contributor to the Wall Street Journal and the New Criterion. Dominic Green, thanks as always for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Connect with Dan and Amy using the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
Dana and Amy, so we're talking about renaming sports teams, you know, like renaming the Washington Redskins, the Washington Foreskins.
Oh, hey.
So that's taken.
The Washington Warriors, thank you. That's leading right now.
I'm voting for Foreskins.
Okay.
And so Boys Town also going to get a makeover.
Yeah, the LGBTQ community members want Boys Town to change its name in an effort to become more gender neutral. Dan, they have 600 signatures on a petition, and they're asking the North Halsted Business Alliance to change the nickname Boys Town, claiming that, are you ready? The name just encourages systemic transphobia, racism, and sexism.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. Here is a white, cisgender, gay man.
I think we should.
I think if you come and look at the actions of the community, you see everyone from men, women, transgendered, people of different races and origin. I think that actions speak louder than words.
I do think that our marginalized communities need a safe space in Chicago, a neighborhood to call their own.
They're saying that people of color looking for inclusive bars have been met with racism.
Mm-hmm.
And also many women frequenting and working in North Halsted businesses have been met with sexism. So
yeah,
they think that changing.
Real sad. Can we just get to it already? What's the name supposed to be?
They want the name to be called North Halsted, which is really boring. But the problem is that Boys Town is ingrained everywhere. Even if you have a bike rack, the bike rack has Boys Town ingrained in the metal.
Yeah,
those phallic looking symbols with the flag all have Boys Town. The name's everywhere.
So we spent a few bucks to do the renaming. So what?
You want to, yeah? Is that going to make people feel safer? Is that going to make the
transgender
siblings of color feel more welcome on North Halsted?
I would suggest Manhole, since that bar has since closed, as I understand it.
Yes.
But again, that's obviously too gendered. So how about just Hole?
Just Hole?
Hole, because that's the focus.
Yeah.
Hole.
So they meet later this week, the North Halsted Business Alliance.
You want to go Sunday? Let's go up to Hole for some dim sum. What do you think? How's that sound?
Hole?
Yeah, meet me. Let's go see the Blue Man Group in the over in Hole.
But it's just weird because Boys Town, they work so hard to get that area and to have that name, and now they're caving to other people. That's a place where you feel most inclusive. Honestly, people wear whatever they want, whatever gender they are. I saw a person, a Speedo, a bra, and stilettos walking down the street the other day.
It's wonderful. I'll take your word for it.
Okay.
Don't wait for me to meet you in Hull.
Okay.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Chicago News Time, 7 o'clock.
More than 10,000 new cases in California. I'm Dave Anthony, Fox News. Only a few other states have hit that daily mark, as the total number of coronavirus cases is around 3 million now in the U.S. Texas the other day.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Don't call it a comeback. He's been here before running for office. This time for United States Senate, he is businessman Willie Wilson, two-time mayoral candidate, who announced last week that he will challenge Dick Durbin and Mark Curran, the Republican nominee for U.S. Senate, as an independent candidate in November, on November 3rd of this year. Willie Wilson, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Yeah, all right. Thanks for having us on again. We're glad to be back on the scene, you know?
So let's just get some housekeeping matters out of the way first. You've got you got to get 20,000 signatures by the third week of July in order to get ballot access, and if I'm generally right, which of course I am,
he's never wrong.
Where are you in that process?
Well, first of all, you don't have to get 25,000 as originally. They dropped it down to 10%. That's 2,500.
Oh,
right. Really? The COVID change. Right. Okay. So 2,500 is a cakewalk. You've got that.
Well. Yeah. It's been a little challenging because of the virus and everything. But we'll probably have. I think we're somewhere right now about 17,000.
Okay,
oh, that's good. So you'll make it.
You're going to be on the ballot. And I also understand that you've put $5 million of your own money into your campaign.
Yeah, I did that yesterday.
Wow.
So this is a serious bid for you. I mean, you've put, obviously, your wealth on the line before in previous campaigns, but I don't recall a downstroke right out of the gate that large when you ran for mayor. So this is you're playing to win.
Yeah, I do. Last time, I think I put about like $1 million when I ran for mayor the first time, and I might, you know, so I, you know, but you know, I think that what happened is that this is a unique time. People scared to come out, and they don't not on the street like they used to. The churches been limited to, you know, open. And so, you know, we're going to come out the box, but we still plan on winning this year. We're going to do some social media and of course, video and TV and stuff like that. But we've been going around the state, you know?
Yeah. Why did you wait so long to announce your candidacy?
Well, basically, you know, I as we sit and we see things, and, you know, I'm not happy with the state. The governor or the mayor or Dick Durbin, he haven't done nothing. He's been at 37 years. And I said, well, I'm not really doing anything. I'm focused on my business. But then I said that, you know, it's kind of like when you get okay financially and you sit around and don't do nothing, it bothers me. So if I could do something to help and change things, I'd get out there. This guy has been off for 37 years, ain't did nothing.
Don't you think that's being a little unfair? I mean, 37 years is not a long time in office in this city and state. Don't you think you should give Durbin a little bit more time? He's still sort of in the probationary period. Don't you think? I mean, I think you're a little unfair to him. He's just starting to get warmed up now. Are you ready for Dick Durbin to call you a token candidate? You know, he likes to use that word token.
Yeah. Well, you know, when Dick Durbin doesn't hear nothing about no people, in my opinion, in the state of Illinois, but especially he haven't been good to the minority community. All right. I'm basically running for everybody. I don't care what you are, but Dick Durbin wouldn't even give me the courage to return my telephone call.
Really?
And after that, I even had them, my congressman to call and ask them to give me a call, and my commissioner do the same thing, but he wouldn't even call me back.
Well, what did you want to say to him?
I wanted to talk about him since I had won the African American War in the city of Chicago, and then this, you know, the state, kind of like, what do you got planned for Social Security? You know, what do you got planned for all this, the virus? How you going to help the people that are dying in these particular wars, and how you going to deal with your job and things, leaving out of state of Illinois, the businesses and things of that nature? I wanted some answer to it, you know, and so he refused to do that. And what are you going to do about, you know, the crime bill he signed, you know, and you know, prison reform and everything? Those are valid questions that I wanted to ask him.
What about federal support for public safety? I note two things that I want to get your comment on. I know this is a local matter, but it necessarily involves the state and the federal government to some extent, or certainly could. One, the Chicago Police Department is disbanding its gang, gun, and saturation teams effective July 23rd.
What?
Cops currently in those units can go back to district patrol or choose other options. Why would you disband your gang, gun, and saturation teams citywide against the backdrop of what has it been? About 300 shootings and 55 dead, including 10 kids under the age of 18 in the last three weekends. That seems curious. And combine that with a new study out of the University of Utah that finds that Chicago's quote-unquote bail reform, which is to provide more condition release for people awaiting trial, including on violent charges, has not shockingly, led to more violent crime, more people out awaiting trial committing crimes when they could have been in police custody awaiting trial. So how do you respond to how the city and Cook County State's attorney and just the political power structure in Chicagoland has responded to the violence on the west and south sides, neighborhoods I know you care a lot about?
Yeah, well, first of all, let me just say this here is that The mayor and the governor and Big Durbin don't have a clue what to do, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
And I admit, if I had to do it over again in terms of endorsing the mayor, I made a mistake. I just put it that way. We all entitled that, of course. I just think I made a heck of a mistake, and I don't know if I had went the other way, would have been the same way or not. Mm-hmm. I don't know. But I didn't have a clue. Now, I'm not for defunding the police department, and I think that the little money that they're trying to save out of there, you can balance your budget and find ways of putting money into the education system and neighborhood economic development, things of that nature, to bring them back. The hundreds of people get shot, all the people got killed out here. They don't care nothing about it. If they did care about them, using this for an example, they took in all of the marijuana thing. They gave them to exclusively all white, and that was that. Now, I did put in for two of the marijuana licenses, but I haven't heard back from them because I want to take that money, if I get one, and give it to the community in terms of school, job, training, and things like that.
They still haven't responded because I know they expanded the program and they did purposely to include women and minorities. And there's nothing. You haven't heard anything back yet?
We haven't heard nothing back as of yet. But I think you got to know how to talk to people. If you don't like somebody, you still got to sit and talk with them. You know, this is not in politics. It shouldn't be personal, but also it shouldn't be about gaining for self. For example, that, and then you got the Senator Durbin. Like, look, he done got $10 million and just people donating to him, like corporation lobbyists,
right,
donated to the campaign. He's a lobbyist. How can you be a lobbyist and be a U.S. Senate? How can you go in the U.S. Senate, don't have any money, and end up being a millionaire?
Great question. But I want to go back to the public safety piece because this is so important. This is an international issue, and more importantly, It's an issue over which we should, I think, have much more of a sense of urgency than our political leadership seems to have about, you know, we're working on it, we're making progress. No, we're not, but we're saying we're making progress. Mm-hmm. You said Lightfoot, Durbin, Pritzker. I'll throw in Kim Fox. You didn't, but I'll throw her in. You can take her out if you want. Don't have a clue about how to deal with policing and public safety in the city of Chicago. I want you to expound on that. And you know, as a United States senator, what would you do to aid local officials if they're willing to accept aid in this fight against gang crime, basically?
Well, basically what we would do, we got to put resources in those areas. The dollars, you got to put training, apprenticeship. If a person in the area is dealing and fighting over drugs and things of that nature, well, look, drugs doesn't pay a lot of money, you know, out there. But same token is that those young men and young ladies who are doing it create the job, apprenticeship, and things of that nature, and give them an income level to come in that outweigh that, all right? Then even just being fair in terms of a tax dollar, I think a resource, is like a resource into the community, then you end up closing the school. You got to pay the police department, in my opinion, and you got to pay the school teaching department. Look, I just think they're underpaid, to be honest with you. You know, you got to take the resource and put it in there. You got to create the federal dollar, like you got CHIP dollar, which got to go. That's local. But getting all the federal dollars, you got to put those programs in places in those minority communities to create economic empowerment. You do the contracts and stuff that the federal government done with major corporations. You know, you put dollars and say, well, hey, you have to deal with those communities and build up infrastructure there, too. And I think by putting those in there and creating jobs, putting up an apprenticeship program into schools, you know, and even into prison, you know, system. So when you get out, you got a job. And when you get out, you got a contract with the federal government. And then you have a place to have a contract to be an entrepreneur.
And where does reparations come in all this? Because I know you've been a big proponent.
Well, reparation comes in. And see, I don't believe that. And this is my opinion. Reparations to me don't mean that every black person get $1 million apiece, right? My bill that I put in there, which is in there, it passed Chicago, City Hall, but I wanted a community task force commission be in there, but they took and gave it to the aldermen, cut out the community, so I didn't like that. But my bill is basically saying that people who below poverty level income, you know, making less than $15,000 or $10,000 a year, need the opportunity to create job by apprenticeship, get to college and things of that nature, open back up some of those schools, fit the school that is closed down, make sure that they can have the resources, the housing and things of that nature, and training, because see, if you don't put no dollars in no community, that creates crime.
Yeah, but also, Willie, you know this as a businessman. It's not just putting dollars into community. It's in whose hands those dollars go, and who has the spending power. So it's one, you know, what we fund in Chicago. Let's just be honest about it. What we funded with the great since the Great Society programs, we funded a poverty bureaucracy. We haven't, you know, funded people who are living in poverty. There's a big difference between those two statements.
Well, I think that it still boils down to, though, the programs. You know, if you take dollars for programming, you know, if you get out of jail, for example, a person walking the street and goes to jail, once you get out, you only need that $25 to get IDs, you know. So when you get out of jail. But I'm thinking of, look, poverty create, in my opinion, crime. And I'm saying if I'm hearing you right, we got to put the resources and programs and things of that nature. Like, for example, the building they stole to me where I live at. That building been going up 5 or 6 years. I've yet seen, except for one time I saw one minority working in there. Mm-hmm. But those taxpayer dollars, all right? But they need to have a training program in there to teach those young men and young ladies and give them the opportunity to be able to get some of those jobs and help build those buildings that is out there going up, all right? But you can see it on the expressways and things of that nature. is that Menard's not in there. So how can you survive if you don't have dollars and job and training? How do you get a job if you don't have the proper training? Then now you got to look at it this way too, with this COVID situation. People ain't working at hotels. They ain't parking cars. No parking lot, nothing.
Right.
So those people can't get food, nothing to eat. But where is the paycheck, the unemployment check, the stimulus check? You're creating something here that's not right. You have to make sure that those resources work. Now, that ain't giving nobody nothing. You're no more than the tax dollars that they already have paid themselves getting back into those communities. I think the word reparation, a lot of people see that it's a handout. You're giving people this and that. Well, I'm a sharecropper, all right? I know what it's like. For 13 years when I worked down in Louisiana, outside my 20 cents per hour that I made after I left off the farm, but before I worked 13 years, that pretty much 13 years, I didn't get paid a penny. And my mother, my father didn't get paid a penny, you know. So we didn't get paid nothing, but we picked the cotton and people bought them up north and down south, and they bought that and paid for it, and so they became, you know, wealthy and things of that nature. So now you get my age, senior citizen, you don't have no social security or nothing like that, but you help build things. Mm-hmm. And I'm saying, look. Create the opportunity now. It's not for people like myself that were fortunate enough, I said blessed enough to be able to make it, you know. But they don't have Social Security or nothing. They staying in houses. They can't even afford the face mask.
Yeah, I mean, I understand that what you're proposing is coming from a good place. We have some difference of opinion on exactly what the particulars are, but I know it's coming from a good place. And it's identifying, obviously, real failures of America over the course of our history, including within your lifetime. There's no question about that. Just getting back to the U.S. Senate race, though, there is a Republican candidate, Mark Curran, who's a county sheriff. He's held public office before in a substantially populated county in Chicago Metro. Why not just throw in with Mark Curran and the Republicans to challenge Dick Durbin? Why this independent candidacy?
Well, I created my own party, the Willie Wilson Party, because I branded myself. My name is already branded. But here's the problem that I see it is here, is that I use my own money. The Republican Party is not inclusion yet, not enough inclusion. Mm-hmm. For minority community, all right? Mm-hmm. All right. And the Democratic Party is that they, and I say it relating, they point blank discriminate against black people. They only come in and use them when they need them. Now, I'm thinking when I ran for president, they wouldn't even let me on the stage in South Carolina, let me on the ticket in Iowa, the Mississippi Supreme Court, which is all white Supreme Court. Rule and made them put me on a ballot in the state of Mississippi. Mm-hmm. All right? And so not enough inclusion there, and there's so much money in politics here, is that is who you have to answer to. All right? They're both Republican and Democrat. All right? I don't want that in my party. I just want to let the people say what they want to do. Now, if somebody want to donate $5 or $10 to my party or something like that, that's fine. But the money in politics on both parties, Republican and Democrat, all right? If the corporation give you a large sum of money, you owe it to them. You owe your life to them, and the people's cut out, all right? I'm trying to say, look, it won't happen under my party, all right? Because the fact of this, let's do something different for the people, all right?
Well, look, I'm a man without a country in Illinois, too, so just like you are. So I get the attitude of charting a new course there, the Willie Party. But before we let you go, I also wanted to get your opinion as we're on the cusp of this election, which you're participating in as a U.S. Senate candidate, but also for presidency, and your assessment of the job President Trump has done and whether or not you think he's a racist, or is it just people who disagree with him and use racist as a way to attack him?
Well, you know what? I think this here is related to saying a person this, this, or that, a racist or non-racist. I say give us a job and opportunity and don't be distracted. You know, mm-hmm. If somebody say that the president is racist and he out and said it's that say what he need to say, and he, everybody open and hears him, all right? Now, that's one thing. Secondly, is that if you don't say and you talk and stay silent about it, like the Democrats say, but the action proven otherwise, because if the Democratic Party was so good to black people and minorities, why is the black community in the situation it is today?
Mm-hmm.
So I say this here. Forget about all of that. Let's put things on the table that bridge the gap between white and black and talk together and do the right thing. And let's talk about things of that nature and forget about the rest of it, because it's just a distraction.
Willie Wilson, Chicago businessman, as you know, two-time candidate for mayor, now candidate, independent candidate for U.S. Senate. Willie, the website where people can get more information about your candidacy?
Willie Wilson for Senate. He's right. Willie Wilson for U.S. Senate.
Willie Wilson.
Okay. Willie Wilson for U.S.
Senate. Willie right. Wilson for U.S. I just want to make sure I got that right here.
Willie Wilson, Senate.
Willie Wilson for Senate. Willie Wilson for Senate.com. All right, we'll confirm that. We'll tweet that out as well. Willie Wilson, thanks so much for joining us. I'm sure we'll talk to you during the campaign, but best of luck on the trail.
All right, thank you all.
Take care.
Thanks. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Hear about the big stories of the day, then talk about them right here on Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. I'll tell you what, this anti-PPP propaganda is much less compelling than a review of corporations underwriting Black Lives Matter. We'll get to that in a second. The Wall Street Journal editorial board has it right. They begin with what do citizens against government waste, Nancy Pelosi's husband, and Jared Kushner's family have in common? All are getting unfairly maligned for having dared take the government's offer of financial help to survive the government-imposed pandemic shutdowns. Yeah, all of these histrionics, including from some conservatives, are totally misguided in my view. And locally, Jim Oberweis has been getting cheap-shotted by the by the lobotomized Chicago press corps.
When they talked about PPP loans and who got what, they started with all Republican-owned companies. And then barely mentioned Mike Madigan, who applied and then yanked his application for PPP because he thought it should go to other people. But they said a hair salon inside the Trump Tower. Oh, my gosh. Well, that hair salon inside that Trump Tower has been hurting for a long time. I have a friend who works there who gets harassed, and she's a liberal. She gets harassed walking in because there's always protesters outside of the Trump Tower.
This is real simple. This is real simple. This was a taking by the government, shutting down people's businesses, preventing people from pursuing their livelihoods, preventing people from making money to subsist. Real simple. It is unconstitutional if there's not compensation. And what the PPP program provided was compensation. And for people saying, yeah, well, there's this case or that case, or there's, you know, this company took it and they didn't need it because they were an essential business. They were still operating. Uncertain times, still uncertain times. You don't know what's coming around the corner. Neither do those businesses. Number one. Number two, it's $500 billion that was pushed out the door in the course of 8 weeks. Are there going to be mistakes, perhaps fraud, you know, fraudsters trying to manipulate the program? Sure. It's a $500 billion federal government program. Show me one that is pristine. Thank you for joining us over on the minarchist side of the ledger and talking about how, you know, major government gambits are generally unwise for all of these inherent reasons. You know, don't recite James Buchanan in public choice theory to me, you know, leftists or big government Republicans or even some conservatives. I mean, come on.
Yeah, but the focus yesterday from Lisa Parker, NBC5, was, you know, they were still selling milk at Oberweis. Why would he pay for a loan? Well, his stores were closed. Well, you know, he sells this thing called ice cream.
Look, the bottom line is this. Employees and overhead. That's what the program was for.
Right.
Jim Oberweis didn't do anything wrong in accessing the money, and neither did any other business. By the way,
Robert De Niro, his restaurant's got $28 million in federal PPP loans.
I don't care. Oh, Grover Norquist, Americans for Tax Reform. This isn't pork. This is disaster relief, a disaster imposed by the government with the policy choice they made.
Willow Creek Church got money.
Churches shouldn't have taken money. That was a mistake. I've said that. But that's a choice. Media shouldn't take money. And some did, and some returned it, and some didn't return it. Going back, we talked to the SBA administrator last week, Carranza. PPP has provided support to some 84% of small business employees, underwriting some 51 million jobs, according to SBA data as of May 30th. Some 5 million small business owners, operators. Are there going to be examples of waste, fraud, and abuse? I'm sure there are. I don't know any offhand, but I'm sure there are. It would not shock me. So I'm not suggesting something that has never existed in a government program, 100% efficiency. But in terms of what the government responsibility was per the consequences it imposed, it's straightforward. And this cheap pot-shotting, as the Wall Street Journal calls it, is nothing more than that. It really isn't. Oh, by the way, and it also, you know, draws people's attention away from talking about things like this. How's Black Lives Matter, that Marxist organization that, along with the socialist Spice Girls in the House, want to dismantle our economy, per Ilhan Omar? Anybody interested in who's financing Black Lives Matter rather than who's getting disaster relief from a government that shut down their business? Which is more important? Thanks to the Heritage Foundation, DoorDash, Deckers, Amazon, Gatorade, Microsoft, 23andMe, Airbnb, Unilever, Bungie, Nabisco, Dropbox, Fitbit, Devolver Digital, Square Enix.
I don't even know what that is.
Game developer. Oh. That game company, Tinder.
Not Tinder. What about Grindr?
How about big companies funding subversive elements in America? Anybody want to pay attention to that? Including Republicans and conservatives complaining about the PPP program, trying to play that grab ass game that the left wants you to play. So dumb. So dumb. Rally to the defense of Jim Oberweis and other business owners. Don't play their game. For more on this, pleased to be joined by Steve Moore, noted economist, Wall Street Journal columnist, author of Trumponomics. Steve, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Hey, Steve, are you there?
Steve.
I am. Can you hear me?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, now we can hear you.
All right. Good morning.
Good morning.
So you heard my cross of gold speech on behalf of the PPP program, and your editorial board opined similarly.
Yeah. Well, I'm not so sure I agree with you this morning, Dan. I'm not so wrong. Big fan of these conservative groups taking government money, especially the nonprofit groups. You know, we had a big debate at Committee to Unleash Prosperity, a number of the other organizations that I've been involved in, and we almost all decided not to take the money.
Well, that's fine. That's fine. I get that. That's fine. But that's a different thing than saying that, you know, this business or this nonprofit or that nonprofit is somehow a bad actor.
Well, look, here, I think you're missing the big point, though. I think, with all due respect, when the government sends out $2 trillion, you're going to have massive fraud. Government program, the $2 trillion program, ever worked. Can you ever show me a program this would work?
No, and I said that.
The fundamental mistake that we, look, at the very beginning of this, Art Laffer and Steve Forbes and I said that the federal government should give loans, L-O-A-N-S, loans to businesses that we repaid the taxpayers when this was over, so that businesses would not fail, so that they could get through this crisis, and then over 5 or 6 years, that money back to you and me, the taxpayer.
Why should they have to take out a loan and have that encumbrance when they didn't shut down their business? Right. The government did.
Because why should I have to pay money for these other companies? Why should I have to pay? I disagree with you that this was a government taking, because everybody suffered from this. Every business across America.
Well,
taking is the government hurts one individual company, one individual industry, but everybody was affected. So in your theory, everybody should just be entitled to everybody else's money. Well, I don't get that theory.
First of all, that's not true. Just in terms of reality on the ground, you had essential businesses that stayed open. So no, not everybody was treated the same.
Also, let's not forget, Dan, that it wasn't the federal government that shut down the federal government. It was the states. So this should not be a. It should be a state. Why should people that didn't shut down have to pay for businesses in New York? I just don't even get the logic of that. And I'm not impugning companies that took money. I know a lot of friends and so on that took this money, and they say it's for businesses, and that's right. But they should have to pay that money back to the government. I mean, my God, we're running a $5 trillion deficit. Because of all these government programs, we should end the program. We should get the economy.
Steve, you're breaking up on us.
Neil's on a chalkboard.
Where your cell phone, where you are, but you're breaking up a little bit.
Can you hear me better now?
Yeah.
Please don't move around.
Okay.
So let's move from PPP, because we have more spending to address, a prospective spending, not money already spent. And that's Trump saying that another check for Americans is on the way. White House wanting $1 trillion in more stimulus/disaster relief spending. I can't imagine that sets well with you and Kudlow and Laffer and the boys.
No, what we ought to do is simply give every company. See, I like policies that affect and help every company. That's why I like the payroll tax cut. It goes to everybody. You're not picking winners and losers. Every single small business in America would get. All we're doing is letting them keep their own money. I'm in favor of that. I'm just not in favor of businesses getting other people's money. And this would. We have a study that shows 3 million jobs would be created by that. The most important thing, I said this last week, I need to say it again. The most important thing is Republicans cannot agree to extend these unemployment benefits that are paying people $600 a week plus the normal unemployment benefits, because you're not going to get to work. Businesses are complaining now around the country. There's for hire signs all over the place with 30 million people unemployed because businesses can't get their workers back on the job.
I agree, and it seems like there's agreement both from McConnell and Trump on that matter, that should not continue, that will not be included in any new.
I'm worried, though, Dan.
You're worried.
I'm worried the Republicans are going to make a deal with Pelosi. They'll say maybe not $600, $400. No, stop that program. Why don't we reward people for working? The heroes of the economy over the last 3 months have been the people who have been working, not the people who are not working.
Agreed. No, I mean, there's agreement there. But so what's the trade off then? They would potentially concede some approximation of the $600 continuing in exchange for what?
Well, there probably will be a payroll tax cut. I don't think we're going to get the whole payroll tax cut, but I think we will get something. Look, Dan, you know what I'm in favor of doing right now? Nothing. Stop.
Yeah.
Stop spending money we don't have. We don't need a phase four. We don't need one. We should just allow the economy to heal, get the businesses reopened, and it's going to be the economy will heal better without all these are not stimulus plans. The government taking money from me and giving it to somebody else is not a stimulus.
I know, but Stephen Moore, what are we going to, I mean, Arizona is now shutting all down. Gyms, bars, nightclubs, movie theaters, water parks, all closed.
Yeah.
And so now the business owners are going through this all over again, and I think that they might need some loans, don't you? Because eventually they'll reopen again, we hope. I mean, and we're probably going to have to go through this again in Illinois. Hope to God not, but it's a chance. It's a possibility.
I'm glad you brought that up, Amy. So I'm going to send you guys a graph. Put it on your website. It shows we grouped the states into five groups. The states that have the strictest lockdowns, all the way down to the group that no lockdowns at all. And what you find, you're going to be shocked by this, the death rate that have the strictest lockdowns is higher than states with zero evidence.
Steve, we're losing you again.
And it's very
funny.
Okay. All right. Well, I guess we're going to have to leave it there with Steve Moore. Steve Moore, economist, Wall Street Journal columnist, author of Trumponomics.
It's news, opinion, insight. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
Dan and Amy, reaction to our conversation with Steve Moore before he dropped off. Chris and Joliet, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Just two quick points. If you're on unemployment, your employer tries to call you back and you refuse, they're obligated to report that and your unemployment stops. And the second point is, you know, to those of us on the street, whether you're a working citizen or a business owner working to run a business, we don't look at this as stimulus money. We look at it as survival funds.
Yeah.
I mean, those are the two exceptions I take to Mr. Moore's comments.
I generally agree with you. Thanks for the call, Chris.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. We've talked quite a bit about the secondary effects of the policy decisions around COVID-19, the shutdowns specifically. So the illness, the death, the lives versus lives calculation.
Versus livelihood, yeah.
Well, no, not versus livelihood. Lives versus lives. Lives of people who get infected with COVID-19 versus the lives of people who suffer from depression, who turn to alcohol, the deaths of despair projections based on the lockdown, understanding how people are, how people react, some percentage of people react when they lose their livelihood, how that has an impact on their physical health and the choices they make.
Well, they're even saying on CNN, of all places, that 1 million extra deaths are going to come from disease and addictions.
Well,
it's nationwide, 1 million.
So there's deaths of despair, and then there's also the people that are fear-addled and thus aren't going to the hospital to get the checkups they need, to get the treatments they need.
Screenings that they need.
The period where you had, quote-unquote, elective procedures sidelined because it was all hands on deck for COVID-19. So it's a much more complicated picture than the press corps presents it to be, of course. And then within specific cohorts, our next guests are focused specifically on military families and the impact that the virus and our response to the virus is having on military families, or at least the threat that our response poses to military families, perhaps disproportionately, as we understand those who served our country have heightened incidences of despair or illnesses, challenges associated with despair. Evan Owens is a co-founder and executive director of Reboot Recovery. Adam Davis is a former law enforcement officer and speaker for Reboot Recovery. And Evan and Adam join us now. Gentlemen, thanks for being with us. Appreciate it.
Hey, thank you so much.
This piece that Evan, you penned with, I assume, your wife, Dr. Jenny Owens, and that is about the clear and present threat to military families during the COVID-19 crisis. And you're not talking about the virus. What are you talking about?
Yeah, I mean, I say in the article and I've said elsewhere, the greatest threat to a lot of veterans and even a lot of first responders during this time is not a virus. That's not the greatest. The greatest threat is often some form of self-destruction, as you alluded to. And a lot of times, you know, routine for all of us is what keeps a lot of us from drifting back into the habits that maybe got us into a difficult situation in the first place, that regimented routine. But when that routine is tossed out the window, a lot of us find ourselves drifting back into those old destructive patterns. And that's really in the work that Reboot Recovery is doing, you know, both with the first responder community, law enforcement, and as well as with the veteran community. Those are the things that we're focused on, because that is truly, I believe, the greatest risk to these populations right now.
And what about, you know, like Alcoholics Anonymous? Because, you know, the whole thing was limiting large gatherings, and people need groups like that, especially during stressful times.
Yeah, I mean, in general, right? I mean, right, we lean on one another for support, for accountability, whether that be from healing from trauma, dealing with addiction, or even keeping maintaining a healthy relationship and marriage, right? We need good people around us to guide us. And without that, sometimes we can kind of all become adrift, and that's no different, and maybe even more so in people that have dealt with some difficult things. And, you know, for a lot of us, we can just sit with our thoughts, and it's okay. But for somebody who's got a lot of horrific thoughts due to their career, sitting with those things and letting them replay in their brain all day and night is not necessarily a good use of their energy and time.
And so that's where the focus on these specific families, military families, first responder families, comes in, because of the heightened incidence of these these potential pitfalls within those communities.
Yeah, and Adam on the call with me, I'll be able to speak to this more. But even obviously with the increased tension between law enforcement community and general public, that's even adding more stress. And it seems like it's becoming harder and harder for people, especially law enforcement right now, to find safe places to process what they feel and what they think and kind of what they are going through.
Yeah.
It's becoming really hard to do that. And maybe, I don't know, maybe Adam can share more on that.
Yeah, you know, I think one of the greatest things we talk to, you know, I've traveled across the country talking to Americans who support law enforcement. And they want to do something. And so we work to create a place for law enforcement to get help, navigate through the issues that they're dealing with. And we've also created a way for people to reach out to law enforcement and help them and show their support. But, you know, having that place, having that community that backs them, because you want law enforcement. You don't want to defund law enforcement. You don't want to disband law enforcement. You need cops in your community. You need good cops, and we need good cops for the foreseeable future. To fight against crime and violence in our community. So, but Evan, I'm sure, can tell you about a great program called Reboot Blue and what we're doing to reach cops and help address and hopefully head off increasing potential for suicide in the law enforcement community as trauma and as this prolongs.
Tell us about Reboot Blue.
Well, yeah, so we have first responder courses around the country that are free to first responders and their families to plug into. But also, if people go to rebootblue.com, we've got a book that actually Adam has written that's called Behind the Badge. It's an amazing book to help people kind of process what day in and day out, a daily guide. But all that being said is to go, if people go to Reboot Blue right now, we're doing kind of a thing where we're trying to put a Behind the Badge book in the hands of every first responder. Every law enforcement officer in the country is about 800 to 900,000 of them. And right now we're just asking Americans, you know, so many people I talk to, they say, man, we want to do something. We don't know what to do. This is an easy thing. They can go online. They can donate. Every $25 donation sends a book to a law enforcement person, puts it right in their hands. And so this is an easy thing you can do. You know, $50 is two books, $75 is three, right? So I mean, this is a very tangible thing, as opposed, you know, outrage is not a strategy for improving the situation. Supporting organizations like us and others who are doing work on the ground with veterans and first responders, that's a real strategy. That's actually working.
That's right.
And Adam, I wanted to ask you this because we have police officers, former officers on the show. Well, I shouldn't say rarely, but since this issue popped up about cops needing personal liability insurance, what is your response to that?
You know, I never thought that a cop would need that. But I mean, the way that things are going now, I mean, you know, I think the city should provide that as a benefit, just like they do their, you know, their health care, the medical coverage. It's provided a certain limited liability insurance there. I think, you know, we've gotten to the point to where you don't know if your city's going to stand behind you. I think we've seen examples of that. And that's sad. That's the age we live in, where politics gets too involved in law enforcement. And that's what you see. But I don't think it's a bad idea.
When it comes to sort of the telltale signs that somebody is in need of help, what is it that people should be sort of on the lookout, family and friends should be on the lookout for with respect to maybe a family or member or a friend who's military or law enforcement?
Thank you for asking that question. If everybody knew the signs, we'd have a smaller problem. So thank you for that. You know, I'd say the first is, If there's been a sudden resurgence of addiction behaviors, that's a big one. If there's increased isolation, a person pulling away from others in their community, another big one that is oftentimes overlooked, a lot of times a trigger for suicidality is a broken relationship. There's a divorce, there's a separation, somebody leaves. Those are signs that we need to get closer to these folks. And then the other one that I would just say is if there's any form of self-neglect or self-harm or even threatening of self-harm or talking about it, those are not necessarily natural behaviors, and we want to get out ahead of those. And a great thing people can do, not everybody is a counselor, but everybody can kind of know, you know, CPR, if you will. And if people do, they can just simply ask questions, make sure the person is doing all right. They can escort them to somebody who can help them and stay with them until they're safe, whether that's a hospital or whether that's going on, you know, a suicide hotline or even getting them registered. If it's less acute, getting them registered for a Reboot Recovery course online for free. I mean, there's all those options. But the important part, sometimes, you know, that escorting piece is what's overlooked. It's sort of like, hey, he's in trouble or she's in trouble, let's just call this number. But doing it with the person and guiding them with them is really, it's shown statistically to really reduce suicide completion.
But you do leave open the possibility, such as in my case, where the person engages in more social isolation and that actually makes them happier. They're actually enjoying being more isolated from humanity. And now they can. I'm just giving you my personal experience, just, you know, the other side of this. And now I do engage in self-destructive behavior. It's called golf. But I'm not so sure. So there's that too. You just have to, you know, the people that are the, you know, the loners in the world, and they enjoy.
We don't have a group for golf recovery. We haven't really gotten into that market.
You should.
But I appreciate your sacrifice, sir.
Thank you. Well, you know, I don't like to throw the term hero around, but.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Evan Owens and Adam Davis. Evan Owens, co-founder and executive director of Reboot Recovery. Adam Davis, former law enforcement officer, speaker for Reboot Recovery. And for more information, including on their Reboot Blue program, the website, gentlemen, Reboot Recovery.
This is rebootblue.com. Rebootblue.com.
Rebootblue.com. Great. Evan Owens, Adam Davis, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks. And they joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Listen to podcast of Dan and Amy from the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
Sports and politics and sports and politics and sports and politics and
intersection.
Arrogance and ignorance. Arrogance, ignorance, and arrogance and ignorance.
Intersection.
Dan and Amy, and what should we change the Chicago Blackhawks nickname to? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636-DA, turnkey.pro text line. I'll let you think about that. I want to get this call in from Jim in Mokena before we get into that. Jim, thanks for the call. You're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Yeah, this is Jim from Mokena. I'm a disabled Vietnam veteran, and for the last 6 years, I worked as a 1099 employee on a professional basis. And I got laid off here because of the epidemic. And I've applied for the PUA, and actually I'm making more money on the PUA than I would be with my part-time job, which may be right. But I feel it's not the money, it's the wanting to feel that I'm still productive and worthwhile. And so I told my employer, hey, I'll still work. I'll work for free. I need the mental challenge. I need to know that I'm productive. And, hey, hopefully I can help you get through this. And when we get over, bring me back on the payroll. But I want to help my company get through this and save other people's jobs.
Yeah, great perspective. Thanks for the call, Jim. Yeah. Appreciate that.
And thanks for your service.
Yeah, no, I mean, that, you know, how many times have we talked about this? Work is not just financial. It is
spiritual.
Soul craft, right? I mean, yes, exactly. It adds meaning to your life. It's not the only thing, but
it helps you get up
something.
In the morning, Dan. That's for sure.
It's true. So the other thing that helps me get up in the morning is helping to redefine our culture in such a way that the identitarians say it should be redefined. And so that's what I want to do here with the Blackhawks. Obviously, the Blackhawks nickname is going to have to go. You're going to have to burn your sweaters, probably some sort of ritual burning.
No, they're not.
I would think. And 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. It's going to happen.
No,
we've conceded it's going to happen. I know they're protesting saying it's not going to happen, which is evidence that it's going to happen. No one is going to fight. And so what do you want to call them? That's what I want to know.
Okay, well, I'm just telling you that the Blackhawks released a statement yesterday. Their name and logo are not going anywhere. And they're committed to, quote, raising the bar even higher in their efforts to increase awareness of Native American culture.
So
the Chicago Blackhawks name and logo symbolize an important and historic person, Blackhawk of Illinois, Sac and Fox Nation.
Yeah, that's so there you have it there. Blackhawks conceding that their name will be changed.
No, they're not changing the name. But, but again, the Redskins weren't going to change their name.
Thank you.
Right.
And now where are they? They're in committee now kicking around names, aren't they?
Yeah, three names. Warriors, Red Hawk.
And Foreskins. Washington Foreskins. Stop. Can you imagine the mascot on the sidelines?
What? Dan, are you talking Foreskin?
Isn't that perfect for D.C.? The Washington D-Heads, right?
I think it was the Washington Red Tails.
Mm-hmm.
There's three names. And then what about the Cleveland Indians? Why are the Cleveland Indians
going
to change their name to Cleveland what? Cleveland what? Catchers? Cleveland what?
The Cleveland LeBrons.
Oh, there you go.
Deborah in Arlington Heights.
If color doesn't matter, why don't we just call them the White Hawks? That would be like more of a peace type name, and it's not an indigenous people's tribe name, so why don't you call it that?
Or could be, thanks for the call, Deborah, Chicago indigenous people. How about Chicago? Chicago is a name that is Native American in
Well, it means rotten
etymology.
Onion.
Yeah, so why not? Right, so how about
the Chicago rotten onions?
How about the Chicago stinky onions? Yeah.
It must have really smelled bad back then, huh?
John and Lombard.
Yeah, you know, I always thought that you name mascots for people that you revere or things that you really, really hold in high esteem. So to honor me, I think they should call them the Bohemians, because I'm Bohemian.
Okay, all right, there you go. Thanks for the call,
Chicago
John.
Chicago Bohemians? Yeah.
Well, he's making a point about, yes, right, when you name a team after a group of people, that is a sign of respect, not ridicule. The thing that has been lost ever since we started with the renaming the names in colleges 20 years ago. I mean, you know, this just keeps there's a lesson here, though, too, right?
Yeah.
The left never stops. How many times over the last decade have we had this conversation? Or at my point, after the last two decades, how many times over the last three decades? And yet they just march on. Maybe we don't get the Blackhawks this time.
But
we'll get
them. They're on the list.
We didn't get the Indians last time, but we got Chief Yahoo. So now the Indians are next. And the Blackhawks are next.
Chiefs?
And the Chiefs are next. We can't get everybody at one time, but we'll just continue our methodical march through this issue, like we will every other issue in advance of cultural Marxism, so that we can engender heaven on earth. It's wonderful. Dave and Racine.
Yes, I have some suggestions for replacement team names for the Washington Redskins. How about the Washington Weasels?
Mm-hmm.
The Cleveland Indians, I would replace that with the Cleveland Mimes, the character from the over-made-up female character from the Drew Carey Show, which took place in Cleveland.
Sure.
And then for the Chicago, how about the Chicago Lightfoots?
Okay. Oh.
Thanks for
so
the call.
The Blackhawks?
Well, that's Native American and etymology, Lightfoot, sort of, perhaps. I don't know, actually, but it sounds like it could be. And plus, we would honor politicians. I mean, obviously, that's in Chicago. Everything should be named after our political betters to honor them for their
the Chicago Dailies
wonderful leadership.
Instead of the Blackhawks.
Brad in the West Loop.
Yeah, since it'll be on the market soon, how about the Chicago Boys Town?
Yeah, I like it. Thanks for the call, Brad. And we can replace the Molly Hatchet with Boys Are Back in Town. The Boys Town, Chicago Boys Town.
The boys are back in town.
Yeah.
The boys are back.
We got the new name and we got the new song.
Okay.
What do you think? Marty downtown.
Marty.
Yeah, the Chicago Hockey Puck, solid Don Rickles.
Okay, very good. Don Rickles has been canceled, though, I'm sorry to report.
Yeah.
He never existed. Ralph and Rantoul.
just call them the Hawks and make the Indian guy look like Ken Harrelson. And then, you know, Ken Harrelson painted up. And then the new Hawks guy can just be can of corn.
Can of corn?
Little duck snort over center ice. Thanks for the call, Ralph. Yeah.
Hawks sounds like Iowa Hawkeyes. We're the Hawks. And then so you it's already taken.
You can also do Hawk Harrelson's Hawk Dance, too.
Oh, yeah.
That's awesome.
Chicken cluck.
Owen and Willowbrook.
Well, if the Redskins and the Indians don't take the name, maybe the Blackhawks can take, like, Chicago Retreaters or Chicago Giver-Uppers, something like that, you know, where,
surrenders.
You know, where they really don't have to fight for their name, you know?
Thanks, Owen. Jerry in Lincoln Park.
Yeah, aren't we going to have to change the whole name? I mean, we can't stop at Blackhawks. We got to eliminate Chicago because isn't that cultural appropriation?
Yeah.
We're taking an Indian term. And nobody asked the Indians if it was okay to call the city Chicago.
Yeah, thanks for the call, Jerry. We've talked about this before when you've had, like, towns in Wisconsin renamed for Indian tribes that were renamed or there was an argument to rename them. And so I don't think we're to the cities yet, but that's coming. So you're just a little bit ahead of the curve. Frank in St. Charles.
Yeah. Hi, Dan and Amy. The song that we learned as kids, Jesus Loves the Children, Red and Yellow, Black and White, the four skin colors.
Oh.
Oh,
thanks for the call, Frank. Mine was F-O-R-E, not F-O-U-R. But I get it. I see what you did
there.
It's
a homophone.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. Let freedom ring this afternoon at 2 with Sean Hannity on AM 560, The Answer.
Dan and Amy and a little error and omission note. I think I said Molly Hatchet instead of Chelsea Dagger. It was close.
Can't keep the ladies straight over there, can
with
you?
With respect to Blackhawks. Yeah. And,
the other side of the pain. Huh?
Yeah, it's these are exhausting times. And also, of course, if we do go with Chicago Boys Towns for the new nickname of the Blackhawks now that the Blackhawks are going to be changing their name. You got to make a decision on whether you use Thin Lizzy's version or the Boomtown Rats. So just something for additional consideration as we're spitballing as a community.
Because this should be, you know, all-inclusive. We're all in this together,
that's right.
Aren't we? We're one big happy family.
We're all in the nickname changes together.
Let's just tear everything down and start anew.
Something else we're all in together, obviously, is COVID-19. We're all in this
the
together.
Vid, man. I call it the vid. It got the hives or the vid.
And the actor you may remember from Bosom Buddies, no, not Peter Scolari, the other one.
Thanks.
He was on the Today Show talking about his and his wife's bouts with COVID-19.
Yeah, they were in Australia filming a movie, and they both got sick.
Uh-huh.
Which he's got type 2 diabetes, and she's a breast cancer survivor. So mm-hmm. They survive, people. It's okay. Mm-hmm. But I think it kind of put a normal face on COVID at the time, because that was the first celebrity couple that got it.
And celebrities are omniscient. There are betters intellectually and in every other way. So it was interesting that Tom Hanks had some things to say about his period of infection that really don't comport with what we know about the virus.
What were they doing for other people was making sure we weren't passing it along to anybody else. We had the coronavirus. We were giving it away to anybody that came within distance to us. And so we were, we were in awfully good hands.
Right.
And we were very much aware of that. We were maybe exploring some brand new territories about the personal as well as the public versions of having COVID-19.
Mm-hmm. Is it me or is he sounding more and more like Forrest Gump?
With respect to the statement he made, it went unremarked upon by Hoda. I mean, come on. Or anybody else on the Today Show, for that matter, it would have. We were infected, and we were giving it away to anyone who came within distance. That's actually not what happens. There's absolutely no science behind that statement. What we know is that the transmission comes from sustained close contact. Which is why you have so many unusual circumstances of, for example, some people transmitting it to some members of their household, but not all members of their household.
Because it has to be sustained. I even read one study where it's got to be sustained contact 3 hours plus.
The bottom line is it's sustained contact, and this continues to spread misinformation that if you have COVID and anybody gets within, you know,
6 feet.
Your 6 foot circle, they immediately get zapped with COVID and infected. And then, of course, it'll be reported as a death sentence if you're anybody with any public profile. It's remarkably ignorant, which is why it's so funny to listen to Tom Hanks talk about those who are ignorant.
What has lingered here is this societal question, really, of doing our part. I don't want to invoke, not everything I say has to be tied to somehow, the war effort back in the during World War II. But there was a sensibility that permeated all of society, which was, do your part. We're all in this together. And that meant doing your part meant there was a tiny bit of stuff that you could do in order to aid the ongoing stasis of an effort that had no sign of its conclusion. World War II went on for an awfully long time, a big portion of everybody's lives. They didn't know that it was going to come to an end, and we don't know what's going to happen with COVID-19. The idea of doing one's part, though, should be so simple. Mm-hmm. Wear a mask, social distance, wash your hands.
Mm-hmm. Oh, another person telling me to wash my hands.
How
spectacular.
I'll buy COVID-19 bonds, Tom. How about that?
There is a darkness on the edge of town here, folks, and it is, let's not confuse the fact. It's killing people. Okay, you can argue what the numbers are. It's not killing that many. The numbers have gone down, et cetera. Yeah, that's right. It's killing people. And you can say, well, you know, traffic accidents kill an awful lot of people, too. Traffic accident happens because a lot of drivers aren't doing their part. Mm-hmm. You know, they're not using their turn signals. They're mm-hmm. driving too fast. They're not paying attention to their environment. I don't know how common sense has somehow been put in question in regards to this. Mm-hmm.
And later, he spoke with Lester Holt, pretty much the same answers, but said, you know, it's like people who, when they first were told to wear seatbelts, they didn't want to wear seatbelts, but now everybody wears their seatbelt. So everybody should just wear their mask.
Do their part.
Do your part.
Do your part. It's a great hashtag. I spoke on my program last night with Dr. Ladapo from UCLA's Geffen School of Medicine. Mm-hmm. Joseph Ladapo. I mean, you know, he's not an actor, so you don't place as much stock in his views on medicine as you do Tom Hanks, obviously, because he's not a Hollywood actor.
No, but he's had it, so he knows. He's down with the struggle.
Ladapo had this to say about what we've discussed all week, the junk science behind the mask mandates.
It's complicated how we got here. You know, you started back in March, so let's go back to March. And even actually some of these calls from the CDC not to wear masks, I think maybe even go back to the very end of January or beginning of February. They were very reasonable. So there have been some randomized controlled trials, masks, mostly to prevent influenza transmission. And the idea is that in an experiment, if you can just randomly assign a treatment or an exposure, you reduce the risk of bias in your interpretation of your findings. Mm-hmm. So basically the highest standard we have for clinical evidence. And the clinical evidence from that highest standard has not been very supportive of general masking as a public health intervention.
But if you don't listen to Tom Hanks, you're ignorant. Chris von Schiffelve, we mentioned before, epidemiologist, specialist in bat-borne viruses. But I understand he's not a Hollywood actor, so he's not as well-versed on COVID-19 as, say, a Tom Hanks. The evidence is hardly strong enough to elevate mask-wearing into the epitome of moral behavior, which is what it has now become, thanks to the efforts of the enlightened like Tom Hanks.
Now there's sort of this hysteria about masks. And it's, for many people, for some people, it's been transformed into a moral issue that undoubtedly is creating more conflict and tension and basically pitting people against each other and leading people to lose sight of the bigger picture, which is how we actually keep the most vulnerable Americans from becoming ill.
Right. You know, like the 1% of the population that represents a majority of the COVID-19 related deaths. Not put to Tom Hanks by Hoda on the Today Show, which is, of course, viewed and distributed exponentially more times than any conversation I or basically anybody else will have with virologists like Chris von Schiffelve or UCLA medical professors and medical doctors like Joseph Ladapo. Oh, and on the matter, since he brought up, did Tom Hanks, the issue of people dying. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, now the new thing, which isn't even about people dying. It's just about the number of cases.
Well, but in April,
changing the way that we keep score.
That's exactly what we're seeing. And it's just terrible. I mean, it really is. For one thing, it's effective. People are actually doing a really good job of presenting the piece of the picture they're, you know, most interested in for whatever reason. And they're not providing context. And it's because of the fear surrounding this virus, they're effective in sort of getting people wrapped up, thinking that never mind the fact that the chance in most communities in the United States right now, the prevalence of active COVID-19 infection is somewhere around 1 in 100, maybe between 1 in 2 people in 100. In some places, it's probably less than 1 in 100. So like that's the chance that like that person that you're seeing is carrying the virus and potentially contagious.
Mm-hmm. But as Melinda Gates says, you know, one person has COVID-19. We all have it because we're all in this together. Hashtag do your part. Hashtag listen to Tom Hanks. Hashtag listen to Melinda Gates. Hashtag don't listen to all of the medical professionals virtually, with maybe one exception, Dr. Gary Slutkin, who have appeared on this show giving you their expertise that runs precisely counter to what you're hearing from know-nothings in the press corps in Hollywood and elsewhere.
And please keep in mind, with testing in April, 100,000 people were tested a day nationwide. Guess what that number is now? 600,000 are being tested, and half who test positive are in the age group from 18 to 44 years of age that do not require hospitalizations.
Yes. Again, we have the highest testing per capita in the world.
Yep.
So which is good.
It is good.
And has everything gone swimmingly about it? No. But you're talking about, I just can't emphasize enough, the concentration of death. And I know death isn't the only poor outcome from this, with scarred lung tissue and that from people who've gotten seriously ill. Understand that. We're not ignoring anything. We're providing context, which is what you don't get virtually anywhere else. You just don't, except on talk radio. It's not just our show. There's a few others, particularly in this station. But you just don't get anywhere else. Why don't you want to provide context? Ever ask yourself that question? Why don't people want to provide context to this? Why don't they want to provide layered analysis of this?
Because they're afraid to know the truth, because they think what they think. They're stubborn in their minds, and they don't want to learn.
Well, yeah,
I always
forward
articles. Like yesterday, a neighbor said to me, well, what about the Russians? And I said, what, that they allegedly paid the Taliban to knock off U.S. soldiers? They didn't do it because it's fake news. That didn't happen. So then I came across an article, you know, solidifying my argument and the facts and the truth, and I emailed it off to her. Like, here you go.
Well, okay.
What do you have to do?
You also have to recognize that some people are not prepared. They have taken a position. They have been whipped into pandemonium. They have gotten to a place they're at now, not through logic, so you can't get them out through logic. Evidence. They are immune to evidence, maybe not to the virus, and maybe to the virus, but certainly to evidence. So you just do what you can with people who are open-minded on the topic. But I, when somebody is unwilling to listen to a dissenting point of view, when somebody is unwilling to consider context that speaks to the intellectual weakness of their position. That's all. Marty in Naperville.
Good morning. Isn't it amazing how Dr. Fauci, who is becoming the Judge Ito of the medical business, has now said yesterday we're going to need masks till at least November 1st? I don't know why he just didn't say November 22nd, but it's just an amazing thing, this mask thing.
Thanks.
And if you look at everybody, looks like they got a toothache. It's just weird.
Yeah, there's something else. Thanks for the comment. There's something else about the mask wearing too.
Well, you miss people's facial, right? If you smile, you got to smile with your eyes to let people know you're happy. Everybody looks miserable.
That's how I take all pictures. I smile with my eyes.
Oh, that's what I thought. You know, you reach the back of the room with your eyes, Dan.
Yeah, no question. Yeah,
look, wait, right now I'm talking to you with my eyes.
Mm-hmm.
Hi.
But there is something seriously about that, which you're pointing up, which is it's dehumanizing.
Yeah.
It's dehumanizing. And we should be a bit wary of policies that numb us to each other's humanity, I think. But that's just me again, and I'm not a Hollywood actor.
The more you listen, the more you'll know. This is Chicago's Morning Answer.
Morning Answer.
On AM 560, The Answer.
Dan and Amy, and please share this video of these two young leftist women offering their rendition of Lee Greenwood's Proud to Be an American. They want to be remembered, and I think they should be for their offering here. I tweeted it out, at Dan Proft. I suggest you retweet it, share with your friends as well.
I'm ashamed to be an American, where not all folks are free. And I won't forget the enslaved who died and built this place for free. So I proudly lift up all the folks who are still oppressed today. Cause there ain't no doubt this ain't our land. Trump and the USA.
F the USA.
Another reason why Dan Proft is single.
Well, that, and also I'm in agreement with John Nolte from Breitbart that white leftist women are the worst people on the planet. They really are.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.